From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the horrific mass shooting in Las Vegas.
You know, I don't know if I have words to describe what we're going through and what these poor, unfortunate victims are going through. We're angry, we're grieving, confused. People are hurting.
President Trump says he'll visit on Wednesday.
In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values.
Gun control advocates, too, speak out.
Your thoughts and prayers aren't going to stop the next shooting. Only action and leadership will do that.
The latest on Las Vegas, next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. At 2:45 this afternoon, President Donald Trump led a moment of silence at the White House South Lawn for victims of the Las Vegas mass shooting. The death toll stands now at least 58 people, more than 500 injured, as Las Vegas, state and federal investigators, and the nation as a whole seek to piece together what could have possibly driven 64-year-old Stephen Paddock to perpetrate one of the worst mass shooting in modern American history. Here's Las Vegas Mayor Caroline Goodman earlier today.
This is a crazed lunatic full of hate. We don't know much about his background, but it certainly is not an extension of what we believe in, what everybody who lives here and works here and those who visit here want to see.
And in Orlando, the suspect's brother, Eric Paddock, says his family is shocked, dismayed, and utterly confused about how this could have happened.
Troy just fell on us. We have absolutely no idea whatsoever. We have no idea why he did this. And that's what you're going to find out is, I can't imagine. When you guys find out why this happened, let us know.
This morning, the president called the shooting an act of pure evil.
In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one. And it always has. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values.
The FBI says Paddock had no known connections to any international terrorist group, not even any significant domestic criminal record. So when a reporter today asked Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo about Paddock's possible motivations, the sheriff could only say this.
No, ma'am, I can't get into the mind of a psychopath at this point.
Well, we will begin our coverage today with Adam Candy. He's an assistant editor and reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. He joins us now from Las Vegas. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Happy to do it.
Well, first of all, tell us, it's been an awful night and day in Las Vegas. What is the mood like in the city?
I don't think the shock has quite worn off yet. I think we're past the panic and chaos of the first few hours. However, I think this would have an effect on any city. I think on Las Vegas, a city that has lived with a fear of this sort of attack for quite a long time, there's a bit of a grim realization of something that had been sort of out there in the air that has come home today.
Yeah. Now, at least 58 people murdered, more than 500 injured. Have local hospitals been able to cope?
That has been quite a challenge. At least five hospitals that we're aware of are treating the victims. We have one level one trauma center at the University Medical Center that obviously saw the most severe of the cases, but there's a doctor shortage in Nevada in the first place. And when it comes to dealing with a massive event like this, I know that they drill and prepare, but to the best of our knowledge, we have not heard about any significant problems thus far.
I think in a sad indicator of how frequent these mass shootings are, I was reading that a university medical center had done a mass casualty drill not that long ago that was led by a first responder from the Pulse nightclub in Florida. So it's awful to think about how quickly those skills were put to use in Las Vegas last night and today. Tell us, what more do we know about the suspect, Stephen Paddock? I mean, it seems that there's so many unanswered questions about him. What's the latest that law enforcement has been saying?
The last we heard from law enforcement was from the Mesquite Police Department, where Mr. Paddock lived. Mesquite is a community about an hour to the northeast of Las Vegas, a small town on the Utah border. They executed a search warrant at his home. They did find some weapons and some ammunition. They did not find any significant clues as to a motive. They did see some electronics that the Las Vegas Police Department will be examining here in the coming hours and days. But there's also going to be a search imminently at a property owned by Mr. Paddock in northern Nevada up near Reno. Police cautioned that search is largely based on speculation from property records, not because of any evidence that they have as to that there could be more clues to the motive there.
Yeah. And have law enforcement officials given any more information about exactly what was found in the Mandalay Bay hotel room from where he was allegedly firing?
We have heard, and I think you probably have seen reported, at least 10 high-powered rifles were taken out of that room. There was some players' card information, some casino players' card information belonging to a woman best described at this point as his companion, Mary Lou Danley, who was determined not to be part of this crime. She's actually out of the country right now. She's still a person of interest for the Las Vegas Police Department. Beyond that, there has not been any significant indication of what was found there. Sheriff Joe Lombardo from the Las Vegas Police Department did say that he had been there for 4 days since September 28th, and that staff from the hotel had come and gone from the room, typically housekeeping staff, and had not noticed anything out of the ordinary.
Yeah, it's chilling to think about. But also, I mean, I imagine this is the Las Vegas Strip. It's a giant hotel, the Mandalay Bay, more than 3,300 rooms, that there must be hours and hours and hours of video footage now also that law enforcement officials are going to go through that might yield some more clues.
As you would imagine, any Las Vegas casino is a surveillance wonderland. There's no aspect of the hotel or casino that is not under a watchful eye. And I have actually gone on a tour of one of those surveillance facilities before, and it's quite massive. I do believe if there's anything that can be gleaned from the last few days of security footage, that they will be able to accomplish that through Mandalay Bay security cameras. Mm.
And Adam, if I may, we here in Boston several years ago went through a massive event ourselves. And so before I let you go, I just want to say how grateful we are for local reporting and the fact that you and your colleagues are there on the ground helping giving us the latest and most accurate assessment about what's happening. So thank you so very much.
Well, we appreciate it. The Las Vegas Sun team has done a great job, just as your NPR colleagues did in Boston.
Yeah. If you mind if I ask, how are you doing?
I'm on not much sleep at this point. No sleep, actually. But I'm just kind of driven by the adrenaline of all this. I'm proud of our team at the Las Vegas Sun, but I'm absolutely heartbroken for my community. I've lived in Las Vegas since 1989. As I mentioned at the outset, we always kind of live with the thought that Las Vegas as a tourist destination with a lot of places where people are packed in tightly could be a place that was an attractive target for something like this. But unfortunately, when that day hits, as you well know from Boston, you're never really prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, Adam Candy is a reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, speaking to us from Las Vegas. Adam, thank you so very much.
No problem.
Well, as you heard Adam say, there are still a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what kind of weapon the suspect used in this terrible mass shooting. So let's turn now to Joe Vince. He was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives for 30 years, where he also led the Crime Gun Analysis Branch. He's now a criminal justice professor at Mount St. Mary's University in Maryland. Joe Vince, welcome to Radio Boston.
Meghna, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. And I just want to give people a little bit of a warning, because what I want to do right now is actually play some sound that we have of the gunfire that rained down so horribly last night in Las Vegas. And it is disturbing to listen to, everyone, but there's a reason why we're going to play it here. So that's a warning for folks who might want to turn their radio off for just a couple of seconds. But here is sound of what happened in Vegas last night. So, Mr. Vince, when you first heard that, you have 30 years of experience. What kind of weapon did you think it was?
Well, I immediately thought it was an assault weapon. It's certainly a fully automatic weapon. The rate of fire is such that it's not just from the pull of the trigger each time. And a semi-automatic can fire very rapidly. I mean, you're just as fast as you can pull the trigger. But this is obviously, the cyclical rate of fire is much, much faster. The other thing is that it's possible, depending, and again, we're going by something that's the audio from TV, mm-hmm. but that it was a drum magazine. In other words, a magazine that could hold 100 rounds. So I'm not going to say for sure it was a specific type of assault weapon, but I definitely believe it was an assault weapon. And this poses a lot of problems, especially the ammunition that's fired from these weapons. When you're talking high-velocity ammunition such as this, it does tremendous damage to the human body. One has to remember that this firearm was designed for the military as a short-range combat weapon and for spraying many rounds at a quick pace, and obviously that did that here. Having said that, the idea of the round is not to absolutely kill or destroy somebody immediately. It's to do a lot of harm to the body, because part of the military thinking behind the round was that, well, let's just have somebody terribly wounded, so it takes two or three other soldiers to take them off the field, and that way we decrease the amount of soldiers that are mm-hmm. there. Mm-hmm. That said, the hospital, as you mentioned with your previous guest, is facing a problem because it devastates the body. There'll be a lot of people that probably will have severe wounds, paraplegic, shattered bones, and a lot of shrapnel that is left there. And therefore, the care afterwards is going to be enormous.
Well, if I may ask, so law enforcement officials, both state and federal, thus far have not said with any, they haven't said at all what kind of weapon or weapons, I should say, the suspect had. Is it possible that that, given what you heard and with your experience, is it possible that it could have been an altered semi-automatic?
Yes, it could have been several things. It's very easy to take a semi-automatic firearm and convert it to a fully automatic firearm. And I'm not going to go in now on how you do that.
Absolutely not.
Like that.
Yeah.
Right. But you can go on the internet and buy parts that will convert guns to do this. You can go to gun shows, and there are unscrupulous people there that sell these types of parts, and then the instructions to do it. So that's also possible. The other thing is, it's possible that it could have been a stolen military weapon or stolen from law enforcement. Law enforcement and the military have had their weapons stolen, and it could be out there. So those two scenarios are quite possible.
Yeah. Well, again, just to reiterate, we don't know exactly what kind of weapon was used, because local and federal law enforcement officials have not said. But we are very glad for your 30 years of experience, Mr. Vince. But let me just play another piece of tape here. This, once again, is Eric Paddock. He's the suspect's brother. And he said that Stephen Paddock had no criminal record. He can't fathom why he may have done it or even how he got the weapons. So here's Eric Paddock.
Find out who sold him the machine gun. There's no... I don't know what else to say. I just... I mean, it's his fault that he did this. I mean, but I'd like to know where he found the machine gun. Because that's not something that's that easy to come by, I assume.
So, Joe Vince, I mean, to that point, like, if, say, it were an automatic weapon, it's very hard to obtain or to buy one of those weapons in the United States. You have to go. You have to be registered with the federal government, do you not?
Yes, if you legally have the weapon.
Yeah.
That's the problem. If you've converted it, obviously you've done something that is illegal. But honestly, we should not be shocked or alarmed this occurred. We've set this up to happen, and I say that our legislators have set this up to occur, because what we've done is we've really taken, we have very little in the way of federal gun laws, and many states have decreased the amount of laws that they have. What we want to do is be preventative. If we're not trying to prevent these from happening, all we're doing is following a trail of blood, and that's what law enforcement has to work with. We have to make sure that people that have firearms should have firearms. In 1934, when the law was passed, before it was out, machine guns were completely outlawed, you could register a firearm. And those firearms registered with the federal government very rarely are stolen and very rarely were used in a crime, if ever. That being said, we don't do that now, and we should do that for assault-type weapons. It's more than a computer check, background check. We go in, and investigators, special agents will go in and check with the community, check with the local police department. And quite frankly, if you are in a bar fight, if you are committing road rage, or if you beat your wife, you shouldn't have a gun. Hmm. And that would stop this. And then the next person that's transferred has to go through that kind of repertoire as far as vetting.
Well, we can talk about sort of federal level possibilities in a moment, but I mean, this happened in Nevada where the gun laws are very, very lax, right? Open carry is legal without a permit. There's no ban on so-called assault weapons, no magazine capacity limit, no purchase limits, no registration, no licensing. I mean, it's a very gun friendly state. So,
right.
and that's not an unfamiliar set of rules for around the nation. So, I mean, it seems as if action, if any, and there's a lot of people who are saying this is not even the right time to talk about this, but would have to happen at the level of all 50 states as well.
Right, and the people that say it's not the right time to talk about it don't want to talk about it, because it's ridiculous to think that we can allow all this to occur and not have these things happening. What a fallacy, whoop and poof statement to say a good guy with a gun will shoot a bad guy with a gun. Right here, you saw where what this bad guy could inflict on people before anyone could get to him.
Hmm.
And there were a lot of good guys in the crowd. There were police officers that were killed, and there were police officers that were wounded in this.
Right.
And we see this everywhere. We saw that in Florida. We saw that in a lot of mass shootings. Matter of fact, Representative Gabby Gifford, when she was shot, there was a man standing right there with a gun, did nothing. The person who apprehended the shooter was unarmed. Last week, a school teacher, a female school teacher, disarmed a shooting student. So this fallacy has no bearing in fact whatsoever. And anybody that thinks that we want to have it as Dodge City, then everybody carrying guns, you're not going to be any safer. Matter of fact, it's going to go the opposite way, and all the studies have showed this.
What is the process now that federal investigators, including those at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, are going through in order to trace these weapons?
Well, they will go to the manufacturer first and trace the weapon down. And hopefully, even after the first retail purchase, they'll be doing interviews. It's a laborious task. It should be a lot easier, but nothing's computerized because it's illegal to computerize these records. Then somebody could say, well, I sold one at a gun show, and the trace stops there because they don't have to keep records. And that's another fallacy. We require dealers to have licenses, but after that, there aren't any, when we should be looking at everybody that's especially purchasing and using assault weapons. Mm-hmm. They have no real sporting purpose. I know a lot of people say, oh, they're good for hunting. But there are some people that say, fishing with a grenade, it works. Well, it might work, but it's not the thing to do. And yeah. It's the same way with this.
You know, we were looking at some numbers from ATF, and the Bureau says that as of April 2017, there were 630,000 machine guns registered in the United States. So what's your response to folks who say, doesn't matter what kind of gun control we add, we may put on now, that will only infringe the rights of law-abiding gun owners. There are already so many weapons out there that it doesn't even matter.
Well, we went through that in 1934, and it took a couple decades to get things back into control, where we were eliminating the gangsters who were using the weapons in the 20s and 30s. And getting down to where they were rarely used. So it's going to happen again, and maybe even more so because of the amount of weapons that are out there. However, if we do nothing, then nothing good is going to happen. And the fact is, the only reason that we don't do something is because there's an industry and a National Rifle Association who wants to make money. This is all about power and money. And there are less people hunting simply because we don't have the land to hunt. Unless you are wealthy and can fly to some faraway place to hunt, it's very difficult to hunt locally. And so what we have to do is find different ways to sell the product. Hmm. And so you start fear in people that, hey, if you don't have a gun, your family's going to get robbed, you're going to get murdered, you're going to get raped, et cetera, which is far from the truth. And the fact that you're going to be able, by having this firearm, this weapon, you are going to be able to safely and effectively, help yourself. Yeah. And that's not the case. You have to have extensive training. And they don't even want that mandated in the law, which it should be for anybody that carries.
Well, Joe Vince was a special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives for 30 years, where he also led the Crime Gun Analysis Branch. He's now a criminal justice professor at Mount St. Mary's University in Maryland. Mr. Vince, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thanks for having me, Megna.
We'll be back with more in just a moment. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back. It's Radio Boston. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. We are talking about the Las Vegas mass shooting. Massacre is another word for it. The worst in modern U.S. history. At least 58 people murdered, 500 more injured. Law enforcement officials say that the alleged shooter, Stephen Paddock, rained down a hellish barrage of bullets from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel last night, and that he'd been checked into the hotel since September 28th. Now, windows do not open in rooms that high, so police say Paddock broke the glass with a device similar to a hammer. More importantly, the suspect had at least 10 other weapons with him in the room, and he'd brought them all in himself. But Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo says Paddock didn't do anything, though, to arouse suspicion.
It wasn't evident that he had weapons in his room. We have determined that there has been employees going to and fro from his room, and nothing nefarious was noticed at this point. That's what we know now.
Well, let's turn to Suzanne Markham-Bagnera. She's a former hotel general manager and now a clinical assistant professor at Boston University School of Hospitality Administration. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you used to run a hotel. What was your first response, your first thought when you heard that this was happening from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay?
Well, ironically, I also happen to have stayed at this hotel and actually sustained my own personal injury where I fractured my knee in a guest room there. And so I had firsthand experience of the hotel staff and the fact that they had a paramedic on site and security. So on that end, I knew that they had team members there to be able to assist and start to handle and deal with that security-related issue.
Okay. So, I mean, because these hotels are massive. They're like huge. Small cities in and of themselves. So it makes a lot of sense that they have first responders on the premises. But are we now looking, I feel like with every one of these mass shootings, these horrible attacks, it's yet another slice of American life that we now have to consider yet a new soft target. Or in this case, the hotel was the place from which the terror reigned. Right. So, but is this something that hotel managers and companies have been thinking about for a while anyway?
I think after each, as you said, each different type of attack, this is an opportunity to look at how you can minimize the probability of an occurrence occurring again in the future. And even after September 11th, we looked at what were the protocols that we do in terms of, do you shelter in place or do you evacuate? When you look at the Boston bombing here, what do we do in a nearby location? How do you handle and deal with your own guests and others trying to get into your building? And so this, too, will be another circumstance where there will be what we consider to be an event postmortem, and we'll look at those situations and how can we prevent that from happening in the future.
You know, one of the first things I thought of was all the locations in Boston, for example, where we have outdoor events and there's a hotel nearby. I was thinking of Copley Square, for example. Mm-hmm. And are we going to just – will security around these events, if they're located in close proximity to these tall buildings – and hotels are particular because you have so many thousands of strangers coming in and out, staying at any – you know, and on any floor. Is security for hotels that are in vicinities of these events going to have to change?
Well, I think it's something that's certainly going to need to be looked at in terms of – what is the protocols? I think Boston has done a remarkable job in the past when we bring different events coming into the city, and what are those procedures to be proactive. And I think this is going to be on the table for a conversation, at least in the near vicinity of a particular event, especially if it's an outdoor event.
Mm. Well, a little earlier today, we spoke with Elizabeth Van Patten. She is an associate professor at Johnson & Wales University in Providence, and she actually specializes in large event planning. And she says this shooting will have, as you're saying also, will have organizers rethinking about how to secure the perimeters of outdoor events.
What is the realm of actual possibility to be able to make sure? What can law enforcement shut down and evacuate to ensure that everybody's going to be safe when they attend an event? And I think that it's really going to change the event, entertainment, and sports industry as a whole. No one ever expected something to happen at 1,200 feet away, 32 floors above the ground level, where individuals just became a target.
So that's Elizabeth Van Patten from Johnson & Wales. Suzanne Markham-Bagnera, it suddenly occurred to me, again, you were a former hotel general manager. We heard Sheriff Lombardo a little earlier say that, hotel staff were coming in and out of the room that mm-hmm. the suspect was staying in. Very normal. It's a hotel. Apparently, he didn't put the Do Not Disturb placard on the door. But is it possible now that hotels and their staff will also have to think of themselves as, you know, eyes and ears for suspicious activity? I mean, maybe they already do. Is it part of their training?
It is part of their training. As having trained housekeepers in the past, that's one of the things we look to do. Everyone at the hotel is a security team, their eyes and ears. And so those room attendants can be those first individuals that can see something. They need to be able to report that to their executive housekeeper to relay it up to decide, is this an issue or concern? If he didn't have that Do Not Disturb sign on, maybe things were put away, or maybe they were left inside of, whether it be his suitcases or his golf caddies. I'm not sure how he brought them in, but it was evidently easy enough that right now he didn't raise any suspicion in the transport of his ammunition and his weaponry.
Now, you teach students who want to enter this industry. Did you talk about it with them this morning?
We did. We talked about it this morning, and I asked them to look through the tragedy of what was happening and really look at how can we look forward and make changes with the industry and understand the direction and the steps that the Mandalay Bay took.
Mm-hmm. Well, Suzanne Markham-Bagnera is clinical assistant professor at Boston University School of Hospitality Administration and a former hotel general manager. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, perhaps like me, you first heard about this horrible tragedy through social media. That's how I found out in the very early hours of this morning when I turned on my Twitter. But in those same early hours, Clark County Sheriff Joe Lombardo had to immediately tamp down misinformation that was surging through social media, misinformation about multiple shooters and possible explosives in and around the Las Vegas Strip. Here's what Sheriff Lombardo said.
There's been multiple phone calls and accusations or conjecture coming through social media that there's multiple shooters at other resorts. That has been proven to be false.
There were false reports about who the shooter was. There were conspiracy theories about who he was and who he may have been affiliated with. All of that surged through Facebook, Google, and Twitter. And again, this just happened in the first hours after the shooting. Well, Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard. She follows politics and political networks on social media, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first, we wanted to have you on because of all the misinformation that so quickly pulsed mm-hmm. through social media about what happened in Las Vegas. Things like 4chan and misinformation coming to the top of Google searches and to the top of Facebook feeds. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, it's pretty complex. Obviously, social media has been fueling misinformation on these topics, and quite understandably in some ways, and also because of the way that you don't have the same kind of editorial control, although we've had situations in which mass media also misreported at first. These are very fast-moving events, and it's they're both deliberate misinformation. There are a lot of people who are claiming that the shooter came from whatever political group they did not like. That happened for a while, and then there's a lot of genuine confusion. But I want to point out another thing here about the misinformation is that as a society, it's very hard for us to deal with these kinds of sort of mass political or sort of mentally disturbed person or whatever the sort of range of things seem to be. That's pretty regularly occurring right now, but it's still not the kind of threat that we think it is. If you sort of consider, like people were talking just a minute ago, on all the security that you need with, like, can you have outdoor events and things like that? I'm horrified too. Like, I turn on my social media and everybody's talking about this, but there's about 80 deaths per day in U.S. highways. Now, I'm for say, like, let's do whatever we can to make highways safer, but there's almost twice the number of people every day. It's a routine event. Whereas this unusual event, which we should also do whatever we can to make it happen less often, it grabs our attention, right? It grabs our attention on social media. It grabs our attention on mass media. And ironically, all this attention we're paying to it, whether correct or misinformation, may be fueling and inspiring the next distorted person to carry out an act like this.
Right.
This has been kind of shown by research a lot recently, is that like the misinformation is a big concern, but I'm also concerned about even if the information is correct, and I'm personally horrified the same way everybody else is horrified.
Yeah.
I understand why we're so glued to our screens, whether they're in our hands or whether they're on television, why everybody's speculating, why there's so much incorrect information going on, but we're kind of in this almost like a trap where we do the same thing. Every time it happens, there's intense search on the person's social media. Everybody trying to find their Facebook profile, and then there's this intense interest in who was this person. There's this speculation.
Yeah,
there's
Zeynep, if I could just jump in here, I'm sorry to interrupt, but if I could just jump in here, I have some particular questions about the effect on our civil society here with this misinformation, because American society is already feels so deeply divided that. We know we have groups out there that are seeking to further that divide. And when I see that very soon in the moments after the shooting that there was there were 4chan threads out there that told its followers to don't let the quote fake news media own the narrative, that they wanted to construct their own narrative based on no facts whatsoever, and that Google was surfacing those threads through its algorithm. Isn't that worrisome?
That is absolutely worrisome. I mean, as I said, the whole thing is worrisome. And what happens with like Google, and it happened with Facebook too. Facebook was surfacing and highlighting sites. Like there was a site that was claiming that was identifying the wrong person and was claiming that person was not a Trump supporter. In fact, did not like Trump, and that was kind of the motivation.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I mean, there's a range of people who do these things, but this kind of misinformation being algorithmically highlighted is a huge problem. But, I mean, even when, as I said, we're in this trap, even when you get the right person, having that person, like mass media focus so much on that person, that's also not helpful. So we have to figure out how do we deal with this information glut in which we're kind of drowning in, which is very understandable. It's a horrific event, but we kind of sort of drown in it, both in misinformation and even if it's correct. And we don't know how to deal with an act, the purpose of which is to drive this kind of attention,
yeah,
and also to divide us and become fodder for people who would like to claim, you know, it was this group or that group. And I was thinking, you know, I'm from the Middle East, and part of what happens whenever this happens is the whole Middle East kind of looks and says, we just hope this is not a Muslim person
mm-hmm,
doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And not because, I mean, you don't want anybody to do this to anybody, but you're afraid that, you know, somebody will start a war because one person from one ethnicity or religious group did that or not. So there's that whole thing, and that's the kind of misinformation. Early on, everybody claims it's whoever the group that you don't like.
Right. Well, I mean, to your point, Richard Spencer, the alt-right leader, his site had a theory that the suspects had converted to Islam, which was wrong. We know that that's not
right. But you may never be able to break into his echo chamber.
Exactly.
I know lots of people who actually believe for a long time, even if the shooter is confirmed to be whoever he is, in this case, a white older guy. They'll believe in their own echo chamber mm-hmm. that he had actually secretly converted and quote-unquote fake news media. So how do you even get a grasp on what the actual risk is, what's the scale of the risk, and what's actually happening? We've lost this common knowledge base through which we can have a reasonable public debate. And how do we, like, we can't even get to the reasonable public debate part because you need a common information base to have that conversation, and everybody's in their own different
Own information bubbles, absolutely. Well, Zeynep Tufekci, Associate Professor at the University of North Carolina and Fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And by the way, we should say that Facebook and Google have both put out statements about the misinformation that surfaced algorithmically. Facebook says our Global Security Operations Center spotted the post this morning and removed it. However, its removal was delayed by a few minutes, allowing it to be screen captured and circulated online. Facebook says it is working to fix the issue. Google has a statement on posting the 4chan thread and said, unfortunately, early this morning, we were briefly surfacing an inaccurate 4chan website. Within hours, the story was algorithmically replaced by relevant results. This should not have appeared for any queries and will continue to make algorithmic improvements to prevent this from happening in the future. Let's hope so. We'll be back. I'm Meghan Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are continuing our coverage of the massacre, the mass shooting in Las Vegas last night, the worst in modern American history, which has killed at least 58 people and injured more than 500. Investigators are trying to piece together why 64-year-old Stephen Paddock, he's the suspect that law enforcement say allegedly carried out the shooting from the 32nd floor of the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas, where he rained down terror and horror in the form of a shower of bullets on a crowd of 22,000 people who were enjoying a concert in Las Vegas. Now, of course, as happens in these mass shootings, the question now urgently turns to the question of gun control. Here's White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders earlier today answering a question from a reporter about a bill that could make it possibly easier to buy a gun equipped with silencers.
I think we need to remember the only person with blood on their hands is that of the shooter. And this isn't a time for us to go after individuals or organizations. I think that we can have those policy conversations, but today is not that day.
But also today, Mark Kelly, husband of Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who survived a shooting in 2011 in Arizona, he said at a press conference outside of the Capitol today that the time for action is now.
Your thoughts and prayers aren't going to stop the next shooting. Only action and leadership will do that.
Well, let's turn now to Louis Clarivas. He teaches security and counterterrorism at UMass Boston. He's also author of Rampage Nation, Securing America from Mass Shootings. Welcome back to the show.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm sorry that we have to have you for each time after these horrible events, because they do happen so very frequently. But we still don't know the motive for this attack. The shooter seems to be alleged shooter seems to be older than usual. I mean, are there any common threads here that we can see so far from other mass shootings in U.S. history?
In terms of the shooter, what we know is it tends to be usually it's males. They tend to operate alone, and they tend to be of a working age, which would be somewhere between, say, 18 and 65. It's a wide range, but if I can, obviously the elephant in the room, the other commonality is, of course, you can't have a mass shooting without a gun. So, I mean, that's the other key factor here, is that obviously this person was able to get their hands on a variety of weapons, according to the authorities, and basically an arsenal. And as you mentioned, was able to rain down a hail of bullets on these poor spectators in Las Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, so let's talk more about that, because as we heard in that tape just now, people are talking about, how much can we look at the availability of weapons? We don't even know exactly what kind of weapons he had, but I mean, is this the right time to talk about it? And if not now, then when?
Yeah, I don't know. If not now, when would be a better time? This is the time to discuss this. And the other thing I would say is, a lot of times people always ask after mass shootings, why? Why did this person do this? You know, what kind of person can do this? I think we also need to be asking how. How did they do this? What kind of weapons did they use? How did they get a hold of those weapons? This is the time to discuss that. And we do know a lot now, based on recent research of mass shootings, as to, you know, what kind of weapons tend to be used in these kind of large-scale, large fatality gun massacres. And the answer is, always seems to come back to, weapons that are equipped with some kind of delivery system that allows them to deliver a large amount of ammunition without having to stop to reload. And that's exactly what we hear in the audio tapes and in the videotapes from last evening's attack.
Right. There's a period of the rapid fire of bullets, and then then silence, and then a repetition of the sound of the bullets again.
Correct. And it could have been one of two scenarios. Either the shooter was switching weapons, or the shooter was switching their ammunition magazines or their belt feeding devices.
Well, I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is from Nevada's governor. He was speaking a little bit earlier today. This is Governor Sandoval. He was very emotional about what happened, obviously, in Las Vegas. He praised first responders, people responding at the scene, even concert goers who helped each other. He said, what we saw in terms of the response and reaction was Nevada at its best, but he said he's also very angry.
So again, there's a lot to learn from all this. It was a cowardly, despicable act that I'm very angry about. There's not much we can do, but we can learn.
Now, I'm not sure if Governor Sandoval there was saying there's not much what we can do about what happened, because it has happened. But what do you make of that comment, though? I mean, it seems as if there's a sense of powerlessness even amongst the very politicians who could make a change.
Yes, it's an unfortunate after effect of all these high-profile mass shootings, whether it's Aurora or Sandy Hook or Orlando and now Las Vegas. You seem to get a group of politicians who kind of don't want to address the gun issue. Like I said, the big elephant in the room, it's kind of like the third rail of politics for them, that they're afraid that they'll face electoral retribution somehow. They propose any kind of sensible regulation of firearms. But again, we know this from other countries who have had similar problems and then corrected those problems. And we also know it from public health and criminal justice research, that there are certain factors that are related to firearms that correlate strongly with high fatality tolls, with the carnage, if you will, of...
Well, Louis, it sounds like we're losing your line here, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to let you go. But that's Louis Clarivas. He teaches security and counterterrorism at UMass Boston and author of Rampage Nation, Securing America from Mass Shootings. So before we go, I want to turn right back to Las Vegas here for just a second. But first, let me play a little bit more tape. This is from Congressman Seth Moulton, and he today said that he was not going to stand in a moment of silence at 2:45, the moment of silence that President Donald Trump led today. And here's why he said he wouldn't do that.
Now is not a time for silence. It's a time for action. It's a time for us to finally come together as Americans and actually do something about this scourge of violence that uniquely affects Americans.
So that's reaction from Massachusetts via Washington from Congressman Seth Moulton. But let's turn back now to Las Vegas and Adam Candy, reporter and assistant editor for the Las Vegas Sun. Adam, thanks for joining us again this hour.
No problem.
So, you know, at the top of the show, I didn't ask you, and I should have. Do we know any more about the victims, survivors? Is there any information about who they were? There are so many of them.
Remember, there were 22,000 people attending the final day of the iHeartRadio Festival last week, of the Route 91 Harvest Festival. And so you are dealing with quite a large amount of people. In terms of victims, we've seen some unconfirmed reports for a couple of folks who are local to Las Vegas, but we don't have those completely confirmed. And obviously, given the sensitivity of the situation, we want to be completely sure before we get out front with any of that. In terms of survivors, we're going to know a lot more in about 6 minutes here at 1 p.m. There's a victim reunification event going on at the Las Vegas Convention Center.
I see. So 1 p.m. Pacific time. Gotcha. Okay.
That is correct.
Okay, yeah. Good. So hopefully we'll be hearing a lot more then, and NPR and WBR will continue to cover that in All Things Considered. But Adam, tell me, the Las Vegas Strip there, so, you know, people from around the world come. What is the situation there now? Is it open, or is the Strip closed down?
You are looking at a situation where the Las Vegas Boulevard is still closed from Sunset Road to Tropicana. That's a swath that covers basically from the edge of McCarran Airport and encompasses the Mandalay Bay, Luxor, Excalibur, Tropicana, for those who are familiar with those resorts. I actually happened to have driven right past that just a few minutes ago, and it looked like some of the freeway exits were beginning to open up again. So I think they're trying to get things back to operation, as they are wont to do in Las Vegas, as quickly as possible, but still working on clearing the scene at the site across from Mandalay Bay.
I see. So do we have any more news then from Mesquite? Because you were telling us earlier how law enforcement officials had executed a search warrant on Paddock's house there. Have they said anything in the past hour about what they may have found?
They have not, and they've actually directed those inquiries back to the Las Vegas Police Department. We have one of our reporters on the ground in Mesquite right now trying to talk to friends and neighbors and acquaintances and see if we can piece together a little bit more of that picture for ourselves.
Mm. How are the casino companies reacting? I mean, this happened in the heart of their community and their business. Have you been able to talk to employees or even executives?
There have been statements issued. The executives have holed up at this point, and I don't blame them. There's not a lot I think they can say in the immediate aftermath that's going to go beyond what was offered in the prepared statements. In terms of employees, we have had a chance to speak with a few, and I think the same prevailing opinions that were among the folks who were outside are also among those who are inside as well.
Yeah. Now, President Trump has said he will visit Las Vegas on Wednesday. And he said he'll stay the day, possibly even more. I imagine that visit would be welcomed by many folks there in terms of him coming to provide whatever help he can as president.
I think that it will be welcomed as a gesture by the president of the United States. I think that President Trump obviously will face the same divided community that he faces throughout the nation when he's here. I'm not sure how folks will react, you know, to the political side. I hope that ultimately it's something that can just be for remembrance of the victims. And just to add one quick moment of context to your previous discussion you were having about Governor Sandoval, he vetoed a background check bill in 2015 that had cleared the Nevada State Legislature, a bill that ultimately was then passed by ballot initiative this year and has not been enforced because the Attorney General of the state, Republican Adam Laxalt, has said that it's not enforceable by the law.
Wow. Well, Adam Candy, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, speaking to us from Las Vegas. Adam, thank you so very much for all your help and all your reporting today.
Meghna, thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.